Hi, I'm Adnan Mahmutovic, and this is Love and Its Discontents podcast. It is a great pleasure to welcome Professor Dr. Sarah Cramsey. She is the Special Chair for Central European Studies at Leiden University, an Assistant Professor of Judaism and Diaspora Studies, and Director of the Austria Central Leiden. She's a historian of Central and Eastern Europe, the global Jewish experience throughout historical time, and the significant Jewish diasporas unleashed from the lands between Berlin and Moscow as a result of the Holocaust, World War II, and post-war events. Her first book, Uprooting the Diaspora, Jewish Belonging and the Ethnic Revolution in Poland and Czechoslovakia, from 1936 to 1946, was named a finalist for the Ernst Frankel Prize for the best book on the Holocaust. Her second book is forthcoming with Indiana University Press and is called The Other Holocaust, Care, Children, and the Jewish Catastrophe. And she just received a grant to be the principal investigator of a project entitled A Century of Care, Invisible Work and Early Child Care in Central and Eastern Europe from 1905 to 2004, or Care Century. Sarah, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolute pleasure. This has been a long time in the making, this conversation. We met a couple of years ago. We met at a conference to which you invited me, and you invited me not just as a researcher but also as a writer and someone who was writing about refugees. And this is your work. It was a beautiful, small, kind of intimate, intense symposium, conference, I just fell in love with your work. The very idea of it, it just spoke to me, so kind of struck some deep chords in me, and with everything I was doing as both as a researcher and as a writer, perhaps more as a writer than as a researcher, I would say, which is perhaps why I liked it that much. So it felt interesting, substantial, and personal at the same time. It just felt so important. And instead, I decided to call this episode "Love and Diapers." So I hope
that's
that is
wonderful.
Okay.
That
I
is
hope
great.
That is okay. Yes,
I'm happy to talk about love and diapers.
Yes,
because you know, we don't usually associate like a diaper that is filled with something, with love, but in fact, one might say this is the highest form of love.
Yes, I would say so too. And in fact, before we go to diapers, I would like us I love starting with something concrete, something that is very tangible, and something everyone can understand, because I think that's where love lies, not just in this these abstract definitions and so on. But I am going to force you right now to begin with, well, maybe not a definition, but I want to ask you, what is love for Sarah Cramsey?
Thank you. That's such a great question. So what is love for Sarah Cramsey? Well, usually when I don't know what to say, I lean on a poem. So I guess in this case, I'll lean on an E.E. Cummings poem, which you might have heard, which is, "I carry you with me, I carry you in my heart." And this is a beautiful poem. It's very short. And he talks about the essentialness of the connection that he has to the person that he loves, E.E. Cummings. And he says, in the second part of the poem, "This is the nip of the bud of the bud of the root of the root of the thing called life. I carry you with me. I carry you in my heart." And I think that if we think about love, there's something so incredibly essential to life, right? How does life begin? How does life get nurtured? But if we want to think about love the way that I'm thinking about love these days, of course, We can think about all different types, but the way that I think about love these days is it's imbricated in the species that we're a part of, and it's imbricated in just how life goes forward. That there's nothing we can do about it. You know, we're to draw on some historical philosophy. We're thrown into, as Heidegger talks about, we're thrown into the lives that we have. We're immer schon in der Welt. We're always already in the world. So we can't really control the parameters of the life that we're given. And in what's so interesting in that sense, like love needs to be, I think, understood in that inevitability of not really knowing, of not having full control. And so I think that love, you know, there's really an element of love that we just can't control. And I really appreciate kind of thinking of it as something, you know, love is something not just that we say, something that we do. So what are the actions that add up to loving another human being?
I couldn't imagine a more beautiful opening than this. Really, you know, E. Cummings, who I've read and taught myself, and that absolutely stunning poem, which compresses all that which you just explained. But and I love the sense of not being in control,
right?
Because it's. It says a lot about, you know, who we are as individuals, and this notion that, you know, we want to control our identity, where we come from, where we are going, and forget that we are a part of this flow of life, as you said, you know, life, that we are part of this flow and that we are responding to things. This is something I've felt, of course, as, you know, as a refugee, then you are in... Then you have no control at all over anything, really. And I know that's what you've researched as well. So I think we can actually go back straight to the diapers, because that is something you absolutely have no control on.
None.
You know, you don't control who puts diapers on you, who changes them, how often. Do you even have diapers?
Right. You know, I mean,
none of that.
Yeah. None of that. And you know what I find. So my research now has really taken a turn towards early childcare. And one of the things that I'm so interested in with when you think about early childcare is obviously this research resonates really well with caretakers. So when I meet people who have children of their own, or I meet people who work with children, and often the people that are working with children are women, often they're underpaid, often they're not really recognized, they can kind of blend in with the background, so to speak, even though they're the ones that are really, we can argue, keeping society going. But you know, what I find so interesting about this invisible work of care, I'm often thinking about it not from the lens of the caretaker, although I do that. I'm often thinking about it from the lens of the very little human being that we all were. So we all of us that have lived past the first few years of human life, we've all shared that experience. It's a collective experience of humanity, of our current humanity and humanity in the past, and none of us have any memory of it. And I find that to be, as a historian, so I'm a historian. As a historian, I struggle to define the collective importance of the past. That's what I think a historian should do. And when I think about this, it presents this huge methodological quandary. How do you write the history of something where the person at the center of it has absolutely no memory of it? So I'm thinking about diapers, you know, the people that are like doing the diapers and the people that are getting the diapers on like their tiny little behinds. A fun fact about diapers that I learned recently. So in Budapest, in District 8, all of the creche there, and I imagine a lot of the creche or the daycares elsewhere in Budapest, up through the 1990s, washed all of the diapers. This one creche that I visited, they washed upwards of 800 cloth diapers a week. And that also means that people didn't necessarily have, you know, washing machines in their apartments. So people were bringing the diapers from the weekend. So the daycare becomes a place not only where you kind of hand it over your child, literally, and you would often help hand your child over naked because there would be like certain things that they would put on the child when they got to the daycare. But it was also a place where you brought the dirty diapers. And I recently visited the Museum of the Creche in Budapest, which is this fascinating museum where they showed me the device that you use to kind of clean the diapers, like in the hot water and the bleach. Could you imagine 800 diapers a day? Cleaning 800 diapers a day, and that's your job day after month, after year, after decade. And this idea of like what we do to contain human poop or pee, like it's an incredibly enveloping thing. And when you're in it, as you know, because you have son number one and son number two and daughter, I should say that one of the ways that I found your work, I was drawn to you not only as a writer and a researcher and an academic, but your social media presence and how you talk so openly about your family and how you say funny things like, well, wife said to me, or son number two said to me. And I'm like, who is this person that's just like telling the world that his wife is insulting him? And by the way, I can't wait to meet her. She sounds wonderful.
She does. She is. Yeah.
But, you know, it's so interesting to kind of think about just the hard work of diapers and how we write a history of diapers, especially in places like communist Europe, where we really didn't have diapers until after 1989. We might have had some in the 1980s. In fact, there was a huge diaper shortage in Warsaw in 1984. And mothers came out on the street because supply chains were interrupted and they weren't able to get like the disposable diapers that they were used to. And it's so interesting how for that part of your life, when you're a caretaker, that's one of the most important things in your life. Do you have diapers? Do you have enough? And it's interesting how quickly that fades once your kids are out of diapers. And, you know, it's almost like a coping mechanism because it's so traumatic to be a caregiver of a very young child, just as it's very traumatic to be a young child wearing diapers.
Absolutely. And you know, from our point of view, we don't just forget about, you know, those facts. We also, you know, don't understand, you know, what diapers looked like 50, I mean, you're saying in the 1980s, you know, or you know, World War II, because in fact, today I spoke to son number one, and he asked me about this interview. I said, we're going to talk about diapers. And they were like, okay, what the hell, Dad? I mean, you are weird, but are you that weird? So I explained, and then he asked, "Well, what did diapers look like?"
Great question.
Great question. Yeah, because all they know, you know, what they look like now. The disposable diapers. You put them on, you take them off, you throw them away. But you know, right, this process that you talk about is quite different. So there's caregiving, even if with disposable diapers, which is luxury. But when you have a process where you have to really remind yourself constantly, this is something you need. It's not something you can be without. You can't just take your kid outside like a little dog and you're just like, okay, poop now. And then, you know, bring it back in.
Right.
And so you have that, the structures, the mechanisms of life, which are at the same time so in your face, in your, like, there's such a huge presence in your life, and especially like if you have families that you have constantly have children, you know. But even if you at the same time that it's so visible and invisible.
Mm-hmm. It's right.
And that is, you know, that paradox that it's like you cannot not see it and feel it. And smell it, you know, all you
smell
use
it,
all
very
the senses.
Important. Yes,
all senses are included in this.
Well, hopefully not taste.
Hopefully not taste, but you know, who knows? Yeah, no, you know, if a kid pees in your face, you are bound to.
Well, this, as you know, this happens, I think, a little bit more so with little boys than with little girls. But
It does. It does. Yes.
But no, this is, you're so right, Adnan. This is one of the things that really drew me to, you know, the topic of early childcare. And, you know, I think one of my teachers is the great cultural historian, Tom LaCour, who has done lots of interesting work from the history of Sunday schools in Britain to the history of masturbation to the history of the dead body. And he taught me that the great historical questions are the ones that could be asked of human beings at any time. Any time from, you know, the beginning of our evolution to Homo sapiens, right? So what does it, any time in any place, this is something that people relentlessly are having to deal with, because I can't think of any parent who I've ever met who hasn't looked at their baby after it's been born and stared at it with a mixture of love and wonder and fear and said, how am I going to keep this thing alive? How am I going to keep this thing alive? Which is why I sometimes think that the history of early childcare should belong to non-human history. It's almost closer to animal history than it is to the history that we think of, because when we think about what it means to be human, right? What does it mean to be like a functioning, rational human being? Obviously, babies don't really fit into that, because, you know, I'm sure you've seen these videos. Maybe you've seen a giraffe being born. The little giraffe calf can like walk right away. This is not the experience of human beings. And I find it so fascinating, especially my students who are wonderful. I really, really appreciate my students, but they often are completely clueless when it comes to questions of early childcare and what breastfeeding is like, what diapers are like, what does it mean to give birth? And these, you know, it's kind of a shame that we're not necessarily explaining at a very, very young age, you know, how difficult, how relentless, how unnatural some of these behaviors are, and to really press people to be like, what assumptions do you have about early childcare, about maternal superiority, about the role that the father should have, about how long people should breastfeed? This is something that else that is really fascinating to me about my work, is how people seem to have very deep inside of them ideas about what early childcare should look like, and they don't even realize it until it's spoken.
Yes. Yes. So all this invisible work, which really, as you say, it constitutes the bulk of everything, of history, really, but it's not history.
It's crazy, isn't it?
It's crazy. It's absolutely insane. Like, I'm doing some event here, you know, right. I'm commemorating something, and that's an event, that's a historical event, you know, there are pictures and all that stuff, right? But that's just a drop in the water of this invisible, which is real history.
And know, also, too, like...
humankind, as you say. Human, inhuman. I love this, that it's almost inhuman.
It's almost inhuman. I mean, have you ever looked? I mean, you know, there's a reason babies kind of look a little alien. I mean, if you look at it, you know, the history of the fetus, right? This is something, where do we put that? Where do we write the history of unborn life? And this gets into very interesting moral questions about, well, when does life begin? And of course, these are political questions, because states and societies and communities around us are making decisions about what pregnant bodies should and should not be able to do with what's inside of them because of questions about when life begins. But, you know, I'm very interested in how... views on these issues, which are timeless, are really quite contingent, that they really change a lot over time. And also depending on where you're looking, which is why I'm so happy in this new project to look very broadly across Central and Eastern Europe. So from Salzburg to Sarajevo to St. Petersburg, you know, kind of looking across many different populations, different ethnicities, different nationalities, different religions, different social classes, and to really try to understand, like, to what extent caring for the very, very young is something that is shared across those spaces and across 100 years.
Yes, and this sharing, I think, we always find things that separate us, that split us apart, that you know, make us look at each other different. And in these cases that you mentioned, it's not just between different ethnicities, religions, nationalities, but also, you know, mother, child, father, right. You know, within the system itself, you're supposed to be taken care of and taking care, but there is so much about carelessness. In these, and when you describe, let's say, these social and you know, political decisions about people's bodies, about you know, what it means to be a mother and all that, a lot of times in the discourse itself, they speak as if it comes from a place of love, but it doesn't.
No, it does not necessarily.
No, right. So it's like, oh, well, we, you know, we care for, you know, pregnant women, and, you know, pregnancy starts here, and, you know, the baby is alive here, and it's all that discourse as if it is about care, and none of it is.
Right.
Yeah, what do you know what the body cares about? So because there is also, it's not just, you know, you're as a person caring for, but your body cares in a way that you're not aware of. I mean, this kind of involuntary, unconscious way of being that you mentioned, that you are exposed. You are not in the driver's seat, really.
Well, and it's also interesting. I mean, maybe this is something that, you know, because there's research that has been done about how the brain of the father changes throughout pregnancy and in the initial, like, months of bonding. But, you know, Lucy Jones has this wonderful book called Matrescence, which is this new book, which talks about how a woman's body changes when she is pregnant. For instance, did you know that the shape of your eyeball can change after you've been pregnant? So I have a astigmatism. So my eye is special. What can I say? I have very special eyes, and they need to be, like, measured in many different ways for me to be able to wear contacts. And the shape of your eyeball can actually change during pregnancy. And I thought I was losing my mind because I was putting my contact back in and it was, like, literally not congealing on my eye like it did before. But once a woman becomes pregnant, even if that pregnancy is not carried to full term, there are imprints of that event in her body for the rest of her life. And, you know, so this kind of gets to this, back to this word natural. Right? What is natural about giving birth, or the natural childbirth movement, or how naturally you should be able to breastfeed or not breastfeed, or, you know, how is a child's behavior, right? How are they natural, or how are they kind of outside any kind of norm that we might have, right? New parents are obsessed with what's the norm, right? My child, how much do they weigh? Or when we think about, like, prenatal testing, right? Is my child ticking the right boxes? And this leads some people to make decisions about whether or not to bring the pregnancy to term. And I'm fascinated, just as in my first book, I was really interested in the idea of what is indigenous. How can people be indigenous or belong to a group or a territory? I became very interested in also this word diaspora. Like, when we talk about a diaspora, how long does someone have to live somewhere before we say they're not a diaspora? Right. So I was very interested in my first book with questions of indigeneity, of belonging, and how those change sometimes quite drastically over a short period of time. In this work, I'm very interested in this idea of what is natural. So what is a natural way for a parent to relate to their child? And this is, in fact, where some of the research that's being done right now on postpartum depression is very, very helpful and useful, because we're beginning to get a sense of, too, how women's voices in the medical record aren't necessarily as clearly represented as they could be. Going all the way back to Freud and his ideas of hysteria, which were often related to issues that women were having with their period, with menstruation, with ovulation, with some of the things that happen in your brain just because of hormones and things like this. And this is something that I was really fascinated when I became a mother. I became a mother later in life. I had three pregnancies, one ended in a miscarriage. So I also have that experience too, to kind of keep in my wheelhouse. And it was very interesting to see how my body did and did not react in natural ways when I gave birth. And I often wondered, would it have been different if I gave birth when I was 18 versus 36? Like, would that have made some kind of a difference in the way that, would it have been different if I wasn't worried about, you know, my career and what would happen to my career during the maternity leave? But these questions about what is natural and also how they kind of interact with inherited cultural values or intentional religious practice. As a historian of religion, as one of my subspecialties, I'm very interested in that.
Yes, and I'm fascinated. You've said so much about this kind of the change, these kind of mutations, in a sense, that I did not know this about the eyeballs. That sounds so extreme. Like, why would that even happen? The shape of the eyeballs, that doesn't make any sense whatsoever. I did read that that depending on the sex of the child, if it's a male fetus or a female fetus, depending on, you know, the hormones, that can actually affect the body of the woman. So that she can get more. I think the article I read stated that that you can find the male genes, the male chromosomes, that her DNA can change after carrying a male child.
Oh my gosh!
And I don't know how that works. I didn't go deep into that science, obviously, and I'm a humanist, right? So I don't know that well. But it was fascinating to hear something, because that's quite a substantial change.
Right.
Yeah.
No, it's, and also too, you know, this gets into other very interesting questions about, you know, how you raise male children versus yes. female children, yes. and, you know, the kind of social, the social assumptions that are embedded in some of the ways that we even talk about, and talk to very, very young children. And as someone who has like two daughters, I'm like very conscious of this. But at the same time, you know, what's crazy about being a child and then having your own children is the fallback. You so easily can fall back into patterns that your parents might have had. And that's really telling to see that happen. And also a little scary, because again, it's not about what you can control, as you were talking about earlier. It's like these quote unquote natural instincts or these immediate reactions. And, you know, in terms of like when we think of love and we think of, you know, sometimes I think that a good way to think about love is to think about kind of restraint, you know, holding back when you feel like you could kind of unleash something that's not so nice. David Foster Wallace, in that wonderful graduation speech that he gave, This Is Water, he talks at the end of that speech about like what love really is. And he said, it's like doing countless minuscule things that are really, really difficult to do day after day. Like just, you know, getting up in the morning and cleaning the coffee pot, because you know that your partner does not clean the coffee pot. And in order to have coffee, you have to clean the coffee pot. You know, it's, you know, these kind of countless things that you have to just dig in deep,
yes,
and say,
accept and you know, appreciate really, because I remember becoming a father. I loved changing diapers so much. You know, I wouldn't let anyone do it. I could get really angry with my wife, you know, when she was doing it, and like she wouldn't, you know, she didn't wait for me. Like, couldn't you wait 5 minutes? You know, a little bit of shit is not going to harm the kid. You know, let me do it. And for the longest period, in fact, the kids wanted me to wash them, until, of course, it became embarrassing.
Could I ask you a question about that?
Yes,
because
please.
You know, was that like some? Because I sometimes feel bad for, you know, like people in the relationship who aren't like the breastfeeding parent, or like, was that a way for you to kind of establish a connection with them, that was kind of your time, like your task with them, versus your wife, who was probably you know, more
doing
used to kind of feeding them.
Other things.
Well, or just yes. like, you know, because they're, you know, this is what's so fascinating about anything that we want to say about like equality and social equality and the right of women to work and paternity leave. At the end of the day, the mother's body does things that the father's body cannot. Or in same-sex relationships, right? If we're looking at two women, like the woman who is producing the milk, and I suppose I can imagine that there would be a situation where both parents could do that in a same-sex female relationship. But you know, it's so. I think when I sometimes feel for like the partner who doesn't have that relationship that's so dependent on this is what the baby needs to do to stay alive. It must be very hard to like. Not have that same obligation, I guess, in an equal partnership.
I agree absolutely, but I want to say something about this when you mentioned breastfeeding, because we assume that is natural.
We do,
but it's not, and having this experience with all my children that you know, breastfeeding did not because they were born through a cesarean, all three of them, and of course, you know, natural processes don't really kick in. You know, that right. the body doesn't send the right signals and all those things. So breastfeeding becomes an undertaking. You know, it becomes like a huge project. For the mother, but also for the father in this case as well, and so that's of course one of the difficulties. But of course, sometimes the postpartum depression and things like that
right.
that kick in. There's just so much that can happen, and each pregnancy is different. I don't know if I don't think I really thought about this rationally. It was just an instinct. That this is my thing, you know, that this is mine, don't touch this.
Right, right.
And I don't know where that came from. And again, that's this involuntary thing. Where does this come from? And, you know, I'm discovering something about myself. Especially because, so in the case of our first child, son number one, because he was, you know, after a long labor, he was born in through a cesarean in order to be saved, right? In order not to die. And then what happens is that, of course, you know, the mother is, wife is exhausted, she is knocked out, you know, and, you know, I'm the one holding him on my chest.
Right. And she has major abdominal surgery, so she
has
can't
major
like...
Exactly. And that means that I, in a sense, I'm from the beginning, I'm doing some things that would be her thing. It would be not, I don't mean obligation, it would be the most natural thing that she's the first one to do it.
Right.
And here I'm in the position of doing it, except that I'm not breastfeeding, I'm not doing any of that, but I'm doing some of these other things, you know, this caretaking. And I don't know if that woke something in me, but that was a unique experience for me. I don't think I even shared it with anyone. It's probably didn't tell anyone until this is probably the first time I'm sharing it with.
Thank you for sharing it with me. That's so interesting.
At all. Yeah, but it was a thing in my family, and that even after the diapers. I would be, you know, they would go to the toilet and they would call me dad. Yeah, no, I want to be, you know, washed, and then, you know, and I'll do that until it was obviously embarrassing and that stopped.
Right.
I miss it so much. You know,
that's wonderful.
So much.
Well, you know, Jerry Seinfeld always said, well, you know, what's great about having kids? They're the only people that when you knock on the door, when they're sitting on the toilet, they'll be like, yeah, come in.
Yes. Come in.
Could you imagine like going to your friends, like knocking on the door and they're like, leave me alone. And the kids are like, nope, just come in.
Yes. That's crazy. That's absolutely crazy. Yes. Oh my God. And, yeah. But that's beautiful, you know, because again, that is about this not being in control,
right?
And just doing things, that feels natural. But then it becomes, of course, it changes. I love what you said also about that things change from time to time, from generation to generation, from, a place to place, depending on what's, if you are in a normal place like in Sweden, we are, and we have childcare and we have pretty much everything under the sun. We are kind of famous for our childcare. In fact, wife worked in a daycare for many years.
Oh wow, I didn't know that.
She did for many years until she got burnt out and had to quit. She missed it a lot, but it was just like way too much. It was so intense.
Well, it is intense.
Yes. So that care taking is a part of her life professionally.
Oh wow, that's so interesting.
But also mine, because I used to be a carer for people with brain damage. So I worked for 13 years. In a sense, that was one of my first jobs that I got when I became a refugee. So in those first years, at first, I got to help this guy, this young student who was blind. So that was one of those things, and then. And then I got a job to care for an older Swedish man, and I stayed with him for 11 years until he died, and then two more years with another younger guy. So you can imagine. Him dealing with diapers dealing with diapers and shit in my life has been a long process. So it's only recently, in a sense, that I've stopped doing that. I'm looking forward to having grandchildren, though, and going back to that. But seriously, so it's not just children, but also having experience of someone being, in fact, a young adult, but being helpless. And you have a team of people who are constantly around you. Your body is exposed to them.
Right.
And they do it professionally. But is there care? Is there love in that work? And should there be love?
Right.
Or should it be done just like mechanically? And if you're older, again, we get into this period in our lives when we might have to wear diapers again. And, so my experience with older people changing their diapers and the way they are kind of embarrassed, but then also really grateful.
Right,
because for them, they are, unlike children, they are aware of that.
Right. Right.
So throughout life, there can be stages in which diapers kind of follow us through our lives, and my experience with diapers, from small children to young adults to old people.
So
I see a whole span of a human life in diapers, so to speak.
Well,
I don't know how else to say it.
Our lives are bookended and punctuated by care.
Mm.
And we can also have major medical emergencies at any point in our life that forces us into, that type of situation where we are reliant on other people. Like it's very humbling to think about not only, the first few years of your life, but also what might be waiting for us. We don't know. And this is, my big lesson as a historian that I'm able to impart to anybody at any time, which is, you think things are good or bad right now, just buckle up. Because as Stefan Zweig wrote in South America, thousands of kilometers away from Salzburg, where he was, one of the most popular novelists in interwar Austria. And so he was forced to leave because he had Jewish ancestry. He's writing this beautiful book called The World of Yesterday. And he wrote in it, it remains an irrefragable law of history that men are denied an awareness of the great trajectories that are going to determine their lives. And, I think, it's so touching to hear you talk about the work that you were doing, this care work. I hope it was not underpaid. I hope it was not taboo, but usually those jobs are. And we see, like in the United States, where I'm from, a real crisis. And we also see it in other countries, countries where politicians will talk about not wanting migrants, knowing full well that the people that are doing most of this care work are coming often from a migrant background. And it's shocking and horrifying to think about, you know, also too, that kind of, I think, imagine if the people that were helping these people that you were helping, or if your wife, when she was working in the daycare, imagine if our society paid them more than they paid anybody else. What would be different about our society? How would that society look if we really sat down and tried to quantify how much work it took? And I think, you know, there's the tendency to look at the work that is associated with that kind of caregiving and to see it as like mind-numbing and just methodical, and that it's not, you know, meaningful or doesn't need like an expertise in a specific way. And, you know, to go back to this really interesting question, like when you're doing care work, how much of that is informed by love? Like how engaged are you? At the conference that we met at, one of the participants talked about the unengaged caregiver, right? The caregiver who might not really enjoy like what they're doing. Wisława Szymborska talks about this in her Nobel Prize speech in 1996, where she talks about the people who have to do certain work, and that this work is maybe loveless, and that this work is not what they want to do. But we haven't, with all of the technological innovations we've had in our society, right? We've put men on the moon. We have these, you know, satellites going around that are connecting us all together. We haven't found any way to make that kind of care work any easier, because at the end of the day, there is no way to robotize that. It's the flesh. It's the work of the flesh. So Jill Lepore, a historian at Harvard who did a lot of work on Benjamin Franklin, the American Revolutionary, and then she turned to his sister, who ended up like taking care of Ben's parents as they aged, and she, you know, lost a few children in childbirth. This is in the 18th century in the United States, when it was still both a colony and then later when it was independent. Work of the flesh, like there needs to be that contact. And so if we're asking ourselves to what extent that work is always like informed by love, I mean, maybe that's a good way for us to think more about, you know, that at a very basic level, maybe love is human contact. That like love is just the, like the touching of two foreign bodies, right? My daughter, she has the softest skin I've ever felt, right? When my older daughter was born, I remember looking at her face and thinking, oh, I'd do anything for her pores. Her pores are amazing. Like, look at her beautiful skin, right? But there's something so tactile about that work. And I, you know, it's interesting how quickly that work could become abusive. If you wanted it to,
yes.
And
yes.
I think so that restraint,
yes.
Maybe that really is the definition or a definition of love, that you're not doing what you could do to a helpless person.
Exactly, because there are so many things that could provoke you into doing something bad.
Right.
Shit smells bad and you go, oh, right? But you may even restrain yourself from doing that.
Right.
So it can be even that subtle that you are, the child is not going to know, right? Whether or not you went, smells nice. Or you're like, right? They won't know. They don't care, right?
Right, right.
So they're blind to that. But you restrain yourself and show like, oh, I'm not going to show how bad this smells. And especially in a situation where like you're taking care of someone who is not your child, where you don't have that, let's say, natural instinct where you, again, you know, you have to restrain yourself and not show that you're disgusting, that this and with time, in my experience, you lose the sense of disgust.
Right.
You know, it still smells bad.
Right.
But you don't have that reaction. So they're already there on that kind of subtle level. There is restraint.
Right.
Let alone if we are angry, we haven't slept well.
Most parents fit into this, right? Not having slept a lot.
Hormones, running amok
right.
in your body, and you just describe, what can happen to female bodies, in a sense, male bodies as well, the bodies of the fathers as well, but
right.
especially female bodies. And there are a million reasons why you could do something bad, but you're not. And same things with what you said about, why don't I just take that coffee pot that was left dirty and just throw it into the wall like every single time. I don't, right? Yeah. So I love this idea that it is restraint.
Love is about restraint, right?
About
that
restraint.
It needs to, but that again, it should, to what extent is love? So it's but love is both an emotion and mm-hmm. it's a habit.
Yes, habit, please.
That's I just think that, I think that that's one
yes.
of the things, if we think about, and also too, over the course of our life, how our idea about what love is changing, or that we're kind of privileging certain things. Like if we're dating somebody when we're 16 versus when we're married to somebody when we're 36, right? We might have different ideas about what we want our loving partner to do. But, there also is one of the things that I love so much about my kids, I'm not sure if you ever did this, because I can't imagine you ever in emotional angst about this type of question, but perhaps you were. I spent so much of my 20s thinking, do I want to have kids? Do I not want to have kids? Do I want to have kids? Do I not want to have kids? And at the end of the day, I was asking myself the wrong question, because I should have been asking, do I want to have Salome? That's the name of my daughter. Or do I want to have Orly? That's the name of my second daughter. And now that I know them, it's a habit, right? There's a proximity to them, because I live with them, and my darling husband, right? So we live together, right? So, but there's something about getting used to somebody and then just enjoying their company, for lack of a better word. And that's one of the things that I think is so nice about any kind of family that we want to create, because we can create lots of different families. And I think, when we think about the caregiver who is breastfeeding a child who isn't her own because she's a wet nurse, right? And before the advent of modern formula, this is how we kept babies alive, when their mothers did not produce enough milk to keep them alive. How could that relationship not have sparks of love and attachment and joy? Not all the time, of course. I mean, joy is not supposed to be something we feel all the time, or it wouldn't be exceptional. Okay. But, I think so much about the emotional attachment of love can be undergirded by the habit of love. And that's something that I think is really great about kids, if they're your own or not. But when you're forced to take care of something that doesn't have any ability to take care of itself, what's your reaction going to be?
Yes, definitely. And habit, I think, is an extremely important word here, because it sounds bad. It sounds something boring, not very exciting, in fact, unpleasant.
Right.
But I do agree that, because how do you know that you actually love someone? Is it because you don't mind the habit?
Right.
You don't mind that. You have accepted that it is something that, of course, you want moments when there is, big emotions and joy and all kinds of things, which there's never a lack of that, especially with children, big emotions. But just this kind of sense of that habit is how you also show love, because it is sustaining something through
right.
time. And that is care. Care is also defined as, sustaining something through time. And it's not just
right.
something you feel in this moment. And especially with, I'm a big kind of, I love these notions of that are, Like, do you know, because you quoted poetry and you've quoted David Foster Wallace, and I just really love that you have access to those kinds of things.
If I was really smart, I'd be a professor of literature. But since I'm not, I'll just be a historian.
I think
if I was very brave, I would be a writer about myself, which is something that you do really beautifully. Well,
maybe that's coming.
Yeah. I don't know about that. We'll see.
We'll see what Salome and Orly say about that. Maybe they will push you into it. Mom, you're a closeted author.
Right.
Yes. Yeah. In fact, I think that would be awesome, because I think you would have a lot to say. There is this line which I have used a number of times, in fact, in this podcast, because it's also something that I've used in my course called Love and Its Discontents. And it's from a short story by Raymond Carver, What We Talk About When We Talk About Love. I don't know if you've read that one. Basically, it's just four people around the table. They're drinking and talking about love. They have different definitions of love. So each one of them has their own definitions. And the main character, who is not a very nice type, he is a heart surgeon, so he gives himself the right to speak. Yeah. And there is this moment where he says, his wife and he, in addition to being in love, they also like each other and enjoy each other's company. And I was always curious about that one. So you're in love, but you can be in love but not like each other and not enjoy each other's company.
Right.
So when you said now that, I like them and I enjoy their company, it really reminded me of that. It really kind of went to the heart of that, because you really distinguish between, love, these big emotions, these big words, and this, habit of liking and enjoying someone's company.
Don't you find people to be really annoying? I mean, people overall are incredible. So it's when you like the people you live with, it's like a huge coup, because you're like, oh my God.
It is. Yes.
I like this. I said to my husband the other day, I said to him just a passing moment on the stairs. I just turned around. I was like, oh, I'm really glad I like you. And he's like, what's wrong with you? Of course you like me.
Right? Yeah.
But I was thinking, like you said, very more deeply, imagine if this is, of course, that's why being human, I think, is so perplexing and so wonderful, right? I mean, human beings, we're just what does Dostoevsky say? Human beings are the only thing in nature that will consistently work outside of its own self-interest.
Oh, yes.
Like human beings will do things that, drink too much or take crazy drugs or do silly things, that is not in their biological interest, i.e. keeping them alive. Right. And this is human. That's why it's kind of you to say that I might have something to say as a writer, but this is why I just enjoy so much focusing on other people, because I just find human beings to be endlessly fascinating. Fascinating.
I do too. And in fact, as a writer, I always thought that other people were more interesting than me. I've written some of these autobiographical essays. A lot of times when actually people asked me to, but for the most of my career, I've been just fascinated by other people, and always thought, other people have far more interesting stories.
In your autobiographical things, you're really talking a lot about other people, because there's other characters, right? That you're referencing in your collections. And
that's right. Yeah,
so it's true that you're kind of what I find so great about your writing and this wonderful article that you wrote recently for the Journal of the International Migration Review is that you're kind of like a tertiary character sometimes in some of the things that you're talking about. And you're kind of, observing yourself talking to your father or talking to somebody else or imagining certain conversations. And I think it's so interesting to kind of think of ourselves off to the side and what's happening you know, where the center of the action is. And oftentimes in our life, the center of the action is not really necessarily within, you know, what we're doing that moment, because decisions are being made both locally and globally that are really impacting the trajectories that we take and the decisions that we are able to make, right?
Absolutely. So, most of the time, you're not in control, and especially if you're exposed to those kinds of things, like war, and become a refugee, and we've spoken about this, this fascination. I mean, I to begin with, I thought that this kind of this human intimacy was impossible, and I thought, maybe that was the effect of the war. But then, everything I've done in life, these meetings, like this meeting with you, for instance, has consistently throughout my life proven me wrong.
Interesting.
Because why would you, you're there, you're an American in the Netherlands, you are a historian, you are all these categories, right?
Incredibly privileged. Incredibly privileged.
Why would you, you get interested in me, and I meet you, and it's like, oh, Sarah is so much more interesting than I am, and I really like her work, and you say, oh, I like your work, but no, I think your work is better. It's almost like one of those sketches, like
Abbott and Costello here, back and forth, and forth.
Yes.
Who's on first?
I'm a huge fan. No, I'm a huge fan.
it's really cool. Yeah. But this is one of the things. I mean, of course, there's so many bad things that are attached to social media. So that's a disclaimer. Yeah. But if it weren't for social media, I don't think I would have ever really gotten to know you. Like, I would have been able to read your work, and I would have been able to, I could have watched you give lectures online, of course, but there was something about being able to see the way that you talked about your life that I just found so refreshing. And that's where social media has this niche to do good, I think, and also just to be able to see the things that you're reading, the things that you're referencing, what's on your mind, what's in your feed that day, what do you think it's important to share with the world? That's once you kind of have, once you kind of trust that person and appreciate the things that that person is putting out there, everything that you post, it makes me think, and I really appreciate that. And this is something too that we missed during COVID, because we didn't kind of have those secondary or tertiary connections. Like, you and I, we don't see each other in our everyday life. We're not in the same field. We're never going to go to professional conferences together, but it's so important that I get to see what you think is important, so that I can begin to be like, well, there's Adnan, and this is his experience, and this is his place in the world and his education. And I know that he has a wonderful heart. So if he's thinking that this is important, and I think it's amazing that we can then follow people who both that we know kind of very lightly, but also people that we don't know and never meet, like Anne Applebaum. I'm always very interested to see the things that she posts about authoritarianism recently. Just the people that I appreciate looking to see what they're thinking about. It's such a good reality check for me to kind of get out of my own head, And that's what a kid is, by the way. That's what a baby is. You'll never feel less in charge of your body and in charge of your time than I think when you have either a very young kid or a kid who needs constant care. And it's amazing. There's no drug like adrenaline. I remember the first time I felt I could kill somebody. The first time I felt I could kill another human being was when my daughter was one day old, and a very nice orderly came into her hospital room in New Orleans, Louisiana, and was trying to withdraw blood from her foot for some genetic testing that the state of Louisiana does. So we'll just bracket that. We'll leave that off to the side, because I'm sure we could talk about what we do to our children and the genetic testing that we take and what that means for ideas about whiteness or superiorities and blah, blah. I was in the bathroom and I heard my baby crying, and she was crying because he was pricking her with a needle, which is a completely normal thing to happen in a hospital. And my husband's like, "What's wrong with you?" And I'm like, "He needs to get away from her, or I'm going to hurt that man."
Yes.
And I never felt that before. I never felt like I could actually jump on someone and injure them. Yes. But that's where like the hormones come in. And so in that way, there is something embedded in our bodies that is waiting to be unleashed, which is so incredible.
It is. You didn't even know that, right? You were surprised yourself.
No, I had no idea.
Yeah,
exactly. No idea at all.
Yeah. I think that just these moments of sharing these things, which I feel say a lot about us. This is one of the reasons why I kept doing this with social media. I always like, okay, well, should I keep it professional? What does it mean to keep it professional? But then, you know, that's not me. It's not the whole me, because even the research I do and all the things that that I do as a writer, as an activist, as a family man, you know, someone who belongs to a community, all those things constitute me, you know, and I felt like, okay, well, this was something I was testing, and I was sharing things. And in the beginning, you know, my family were a little bit skeptical, of course. You know, oh, Dad, you're saying these things. Everyone is going to laugh at us. You know, they will think we are ridiculous. And, you know, well, you're a professor and you shouldn't be saying these things. You know? Yeah. But I felt the opposite. Like, if I'm going to be honest, if I'm going to be able to say anything substantial, anything, you know, deep, then I need to be open, like fully open. And if, you know, if someone laughs and they think, I don't know, you're ridiculous, you have nothing to say, well, you know, whatever, I don't care. And what happened was, in a sense, what you were saying now was this discovery that, and this is one of the reasons I'm still using social media, especially in this way, and my family came to appreciate this, was that a lot of people were following me for that.
That's so interesting.
They wanted to see this kind of big picture. I didn't even know this until I was supposed to give a lecture. And I prepared, of course, and the person introducing me said, well, you know, he is this and that, and, you know, just, you know, like I did with you in the beginning with, you know, the CV, the books, whatever, you know, all that stuff. And then said, well, what we all really like is just following this, like, sitcom that is going on Facebook. Yeah.
It's wonderful. You know, and I think too, like for our students, you know, our students, what I've noticed, especially in light of recent political developments, our students, they just want guidance. They don't want us to tell them how to think. They don't want us to say that it has to be this way or it has to be that way. What our students want is they want to know what we're reading. They want to know what we're thinking. They want to know when we're confused, and they want to get deep knowledge from us when they can. So what kind of deep knowledge can I impart to my students? What am I really an expert in? And then explaining to them too, like, so this is what I'm reading. These are the newspapers that I'm paying for a subscription for, because they're actually doing really good journalism, and I want to support that. Like, I have a certain amount of money that I can pay for my media, and this is what I'm going to support because I appreciate that journalist and I appreciate that author. And this is one of the things that's so scary when we see how people who work at universities can be put under such a microscope, right? Because often we're not saying these things in class, right? We can't divorce ourselves and when we're lecturing from like who we are as a person, but we're not necessarily being honest to this extent. And for the students that really want to see that, I think that's so important, because I have noticed that young people today, they just need guidance. They need help because they don't know what's true and what's not true. And I might not always know that either. But at least I can tell them, you know, this is who you should listen to, and then listen to this person and see how they disagree, and then figure out like how you make sense of this. Because you know, the issues that we're dealing with politically, with the rise of certain types of politicians who don't necessarily want there to be free speech, or if we're thinking about the war between Russia and Ukraine, if we're thinking about what's happening in Gaza or Israel-Palestine more broadly, what our students need is they need people who are honest with them. I can't tell you this, that, or that, but this is what I read to think more deeply about that. And hopefully then I can come up with where I think I stand. And so that's where that social media presence, like that's a voluntary thing that's so important for your students to have access to it if they want to.
I agree. And that it is safe to be in your zone, you know, that you can talk about things, that there is still, you know, freedom to speak and to talk and not know. Right. And not always know what you feel and why you're feeling it. Those kinds of things, because everything is telling you, you know, what you should feel and what you should think. There's way too much of that, and just this sense of empathy, and that's of course connected to caregiving. Empathy comes right. from that. That how do you learn empathy? And Elon Musk said that, you know, the bug or the virus of the Western civilization was too much empathy. And can you imagine saying something like that?
How do you
as a historian, you know,
luckily knowing, he doesn't have any children.
He should change more diapers. So he wants to kind of doge empathy out of the Western civilization, as if there is enough of it. There's too little of it. And from the point of view of someone like that, there is too much of it. And you know, what kind of a worldview do we have?
Yeah. I mean, to be a historian, you have to have deep levels of empathy, right? As Harper Lee says, you don't really know someone until you put on their shoes and walk around in them for a little bit, right? When I really started to understand what was happening in occupied Poland, the part of Poland that was occupied by Nazi Germany in the 1940s, it was the diary of a Christian doctor named Zygmunt Klukowski, who really helped me and my students begin to understand what occupation looked like for everyone. And it's impossible to understand the Jewish experience. It's impossible to understand what happens in Poland after 1945 without really understanding like what was going on in Polish society, right? Really trying to understand like how everyday individual people were experiencing this really brutal occupation. And it's really difficult to have the patience to kind of sit through a diary and like read through it. It's very, very difficult to take yourself. Most likely you're coming from a place of comfort, but not necessarily, but to, you know, cast yourself back to, you know, a horrible time where there's vast human suffering. Keeping in mind that this is issues that we have today as we, you know, walk around and go for nice dinners and we know people are starving and sometimes they're starving like a few kilometers away from where you are, right? This is deep, deep, horrible injustice that we have in our world that we're just trying to negotiate it. And I don't necessarily know if I'm doing a good job of it or not. But when I talk about my work as a historian in the past, empathy is so important for really trying to understand what it was like to live at another time and place. And, you know, these ideas about what does it really mean to be empathetic? My favorite rabbi in the Talmud is Rabbi Yossi, who constantly, when he's asked, like, what makes a good person? He's like, a good person is a good neighbor. If you want to be a good person, be a good neighbor. And this is a category historically that I think we can really plunge into much more to be like, what does it mean to be a good neighbor, right? There's restraint embedded in that as well, because to be a good neighbor means you're not going to like blast your music. It means that you're not going to, you know, like bang on the wall or try to burn down the house or, you know, this kind of thing. But there's something about living side by side with people, and we can think about side by side in both like small ways, but then, you know, a bit larger, you know, what's happening across the town that we're living in, what's happening across the country, what's happening across the continent, the world, right? But, you know, this idea about empathy and really trying to understand why people do what they do. This is one of the things that I think is really hard with young children, because it's hard to know why they're doing what they're doing sometimes. Mm-hmm. Like a toddler, right?
Yes.
Why are they still fighting brushing their teeth, yes, knowing that we brush their teeth all the time, yes, and they have to brush their teeth at least twice a day? You know, or my daughter, my older daughter, she would always like think that we weren't going to feed her her bottle. And I'm like, have I ever withheld food from you ever in your life? But you see to a certain extent how untrusting the human condition is. And, you know, if we think about something like human nature, the human condition, dealing with very young children really helps us test what we think the limits of that are, right? How, what is the human condition? What are we like really like when we're raw? And, you know, that's what I think is really interesting. That's what caregivers are dealing with. And the amount of empathy it takes, I don't know how empathy is connected to love. Obviously, there's a connection, but I think it's really complicated, you know, and how much of our love springs from, you know, trying to be empathetic towards the other person. Are we more empathetic towards our kids than our partner, than our kids towards our parents? Should there be kind of like an equality of that empathy across all these different love relationships? I'm not sure. What do you think?
Oh, no, it's the big questions, really. It's whether or not, you know, so if you start measuring things there and even socially, you know, where you should feel what and to what extent, because there are socially accepted levels. So you are supposed to, of course, love your children more than...
Right,
and so there must be, you know, these hierarchies of love and care. The thing with neighbors, I of course love that, and I have two different experiences with neighbors. And one is, of course, here in Sweden, we are famous for not really wanting to meet our neighbors. You know, so the stereotype about Swedes is that before we go out, we check if they if there's anyone in the corridor, and if there's none, then you just kind of rush out, and you know, in case you see someone, then you wait until they're gone. And so that's the stereotype, but unfortunately almost all my neighbors in this building where I live now have been like that. So so they've actually had kids, and the kids have grown, and I've maybe seen the kids like three times when they are like 1 and 3 years old and 7, you know, and then they're getting married or whatever.
Yeah, that's so crazy.
A little bit like that. But in Bosnia, we have really great neighbors. They're taking care of our house, and you know, sometimes they open the windows. We, you know, they have our keys, and they,
right.
Open the windows before we come, and you know, clean a little bit of what really, really amazing. So there are different. You see, as a Bosnian Swede, I'm a little schizophrenic when it comes to, you know, what it means to be a neighbor. So I want to be both ways.
That's so funny. Know?
And one thing that you mentioned earlier, which I think is really interesting in terms of, well, being a neighbor, but also and caring and loving, is the wet nursing, I think, right?
So interesting.
Because that is such an amazing, it's not done so much now. And I almost wish we could go back, like make wet nursing great again or something like that.
I know. Wouldn't that be interesting? Wet nursing is so, you know, my sister and I were pregnant at the same time. And I said to her, oh, if we lived like next to each other, you could breastfeed my child.
Yes.
And she's like, yeah, but we don't live next to each other, so I'm not going to do it.
It would be great, because like we are almost, it's become almost like an extinct thing. And I don't know, if you could, you would still like, oh no, I'm not going to bother anyone, and I'm not going to push myself onto, you know, this family and suggest. I mean, imagine you go like, oh, I would like to breastfeed your kid. I mean, that would be a weird thing to say now, right? If you came to me and it's like, okay, well, I have a lot of milk, I'll just, you know, breastfeed your kid if that's okay.
Right.
You wouldn't do that.
We have like milk donations, yes. So people like pump and then donate. But yeah. I'm sure
but not
in,
that,
in
that
Bosnian,
touch that you talked about before, you know, that there is right. the intimacy, you know,
right.
pumping out the milk and, you know, depositing, that's still a bit, right. you know.
But I'm sure in Bosnian, there's a similar idea that we have in like Czech and Slovak, which is to be a brother or sister, pomleka.
Yes.
So a brother and what's interesting is that there are some ideas, some both religious and cultural ideas about what you can and cannot do then.
That's right.
With those people, because the idea is that breast milk would have some kind of a special quality, right? That would, you know, kind of, that would only be almost to be the equivalent of like inbreeding or incest if you're kind of being intimate with that kind of person. And I think it really kind of goes back to just to a time too when there was no alternative. So the rise of formula, just like the rise of disposable diapers in the 20th century, it completely changes care. It changes like what a mother is responsible for. It changes like what like costs. It changes like, because of technology, I mean, the technology of the diapers, of there's the technology of like the baby bottle and the formula itself. But yeah, wet nursing is so interesting, especially when you see it across like religious or ethnic, presumed religious or presumed ethnic boundaries, keeping in mind that most people, when they're living in a society, there is some of this like neighbor aspect that you're just trying to make it through. I mean, keeping children alive is something that one could imagine all members in a society would be for, although we know that that's not necessarily the case.
Yes. And in fact, what you say, I'm from a Muslim family, and in Islam, in fact, if you breastfeed someone like three times, you count as a real mother. Like a biological mother, and you cannot marry her children. So that would
that's
be incest.
So, fascinating.
So it's that strict, like three times. That doesn't sound like a lot, but it's, you know, on that level. So
right.
you're quite
it's like
right.
It's beyond an emergency.
Yes.
Like you can imagine like once or twice because there's an
yes.
emergency,
yes.
but the idea is that, okay, three times,
three
that's
times.
Too much.
Yes. And it's a
that's
habit,
really
right? You've done it like a couple, yeah, so it's already in that. It's stunning because... I mean, seriously, you would say that three times, that's just, you know, a bottle
right.
of milk. You don't think, like, the quantity is that big. But here, it's like a, I don't know, it's almost like just a biological, but also some kind of, like, a spiritual or
right.
Category as
right.
As
no,
well.
It's
yeah.
And, you know, I think this idea of like a liquid that's coming from a woman, but it's only coming after she you know, has a child herself. There's something that it's always interesting to see what like religious authorities in the past who are mainly men, but often, unless they're like part of a religious sect that doesn't promote celibacy. So let's take the Catholic priests and just move them for a second. Sorry, Pope Leo, we're going to not talk about you for a second. But they often have, some of these religious authorities have a lot of knowledge about women and giving birth, or at least they think they have a lot of knowledge, right? And it's always very interesting to see like what people think about these things and like what they think is best, right? And that gets to this really, really deep part of my work, which is assumptions about maternal superiority. Like, what do we think a mother should be or shouldn't be?
Oh, that is so beautiful. In a sense, we came back to that, what we started with, how we think of ourselves and where we place ourselves in societies and politics and all those things, religion and all that. This has been so amazing, this conversation. I've just enjoyed
Wonderful.
It enjoyed it so much. Sarah, I cannot thank you enough for talking to me.
Thank you. I hope your son learns a lot about diapers when he listens
yeah.
to it, as I'm sure your son listens to all of your podcasts.
Let's not go there.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you,
I'm such a fan of your work. Thank you.
And I'm infused.
No, 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 no.